They're actually in South Philadelphia, the best part of Philadelphia. Why do I say that? Because I'm born and reared here. It's anything south of Market Street, of course, is South Philadelphia. And it's we like to think it's the best part of the city, and to the extent that we never dated the girls up there in North Philadelphia where Walter Williams and Bill Cosby grew up, especially in the Richard Allen homes. And then we wouldn't let them come down and date our girls in South Philly. We boast of a lot of prominent people in South Philadelphia, and many of the names you know, Marian Anderson, Mario Lanza, Chubby Checker, Frankie and Avalon, Bobby Ridarelli, as you know, and Bobby Rydell, and Fabian Forte is his name, Sherman Hemsley, Kenny Gamble, Joey Bishop, of course, the home of the Academy of Music, the Kimmel Center now, which is the new Performing Arts Center, which is really the place for the Philadelphia Orchestra, because for years, the Philadelphia Orchestra was homeless. The Academy of Music was a replica of the Opera House in Milan, and for 70, 80, 90 years, they were looking for a home. And frankly, they were looking at the Four Seasons back in the 1930s and put down millions of dollars on that property, architectural plans and all of that, and never developed it. So those of us who've been in the capital campaign business and any kind of a venture can understand how painful that can be. But even an august group like the Philadelphia Orchestra just got a home a few years ago with the Kimmel Center. And it was never acoustically proper for the orchestra. It was an opera house. South Philly is also known as a venue for the Navy Yard. Of course, the old Municipal Stadium, which became the John F. Kennedy Memorial Stadium, where the Army and Navy game was played. The Vet, which was finally imploded. And now we have the Citizens Bank Field, where the Phillies play. And of course, the Lincoln National Park and Field, where the Philadelphia Eagles play. And, of course, we have down there a whole host of other prominent things in South Philly, like the two famous cheesesteaks places. Ron Pearson, the contrary, notwithstanding, we have Geno's and Pat's. Ron has another favorite in this town somewhere. Who knows? And who cares? We have the Middle East restaurant from which I used to broadcast back in 1967, 69, before we got thrown off the air by the FCC, and we're doing a talk show, which is 3 hours a day or evening, like what the guys are doing today, Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh and Gordon Liddy and Laura Ingraham and the rest of them. And I might add that we had a lot of fun doing that. I'll get back to that in a split second. But growing up in South Philadelphia, my 89-year-old mom, who'll be 90 years old in January, is still living in the second row house that we grew up in South Philly, 23rd and Christian. Just a matter of blocks from here, really. Don't tell I'm in town. I haven't been able to see her yet. And she's there with two of my siblings, so we don't have to worry about it. And she's in perfect health, just as cantankerous as ever. Very loving individual. Happened to marry probably not the best guy in the world, but my dad, who passed away 7 years ago now. And he was a classical dad in the sense that he didn't come home every Friday when he got paid and bring the money home and that sort of thing. So it's you're scuffling to pay the rent and to feed then 5 kids, eventually 7. And so didn't take me long, and this is the most important part. By the time I was about 9 years old, my older brother and I used to junk papers, as we call it, go and collect newspapers and magazines and things, and as far north from Christian Street to up here, at least the Locust Street, which is a block away from here. And we would then recycle or sell the papers to the junk shop for a penny a pound. So if you had 100 pounds of paper, then you made a buck on a Saturday morning. This is what we were doing this time on a Saturday morning. And back, you know, post-World War II, during the war, it was a lot of money for young kids. So by the time I was, odds and ends, jobs we would do for individuals, carry their orders from the supermarket. We would put their trash out, their ashes out, if you will, because people burn coal, so you're putting the ashes out. And you would make a dime or a quarter, and it accumulated. And we could sustain ourselves. My older brother and I did it on a regular basis. And it got to be a habit, just working. Got to the point we didn't know any better. But by the time I was 9 years old, I think I had this thing figured out. And simply because a loving mother would promise you this and that for Easter, new suit, something of that sort. If you got it, you got it at the last minute. Or for Christmas, you'd be promised something, couldn't produce it. The resources were simply not there. And after a while, you realize there is no Santa Claus and there's no Easter Bunny. And you start to figure out what this is all about. In the meantime, you're junking these papers and you're reading the newspaper, the Inquirer, the Record, the Bulletin, four or five papers in the city of Philadelphia at the time. And you would see off on City Line Avenue, as it was called then, now City Avenue, but across there where Al Haig grew up in Marion. And he, of course, went to St. Matthias before he went to went to Lower Marion High School. And the other people, the vexatious people of the old Davis Cup tennis player, Roger Penske, lived in Villanova, used to drive sports cars in Vineland, New Jersey, Watkins Glen, places like that. And, of course, you know him with the big trucking company and, of course, a big engine company as well. They came from a privileged family. And when you would read these newspapers before you would tie them up in the bundles, and you would find out something's going on over there in another part of the city, another area of our section of Philadelphia, or the greater Philadelphia area, and you wonder why you were born at 24th and Carpenter, 23rd and Christian, and they're over there enjoying the so-called good life. Well, he said, there's no trust fund that I'm going to benefit from, and I'm not going to have what I think I want to have or I should have. And I think it just made me stop and realize that I'm going to have to scuffle for everything that I'm going to get in this world. Because if I sit around and wait for somebody to give it to me, it's not going to happen. And so I was 9 years old when that happened. And so basically what I'm saying is I have no conversion story to tell. And it's not some point when I read, Bassiet, or I read Milton Friedman, or Bill Buckley's God and Man at Yale, or Russell Kirk's Conservative Mind, or Human Events, or Modern Age. It was then that I came a very lean, mean individual, and to the point that I was going to stand on my own two feet and not depend upon other people to do it for me. And God knows, there's one person in this room who has probably done more for me than anybody, and that's Lee Edwards. But the key is, I've never been an undue burden on him, but at the same time, he's done more for me than probably anybody in this room as an individual. Taught me a lot. Go back some of the other old-timers in the movement, Frank and Elsie Meyer, and of course George Skyler, Max Juergen, Bill Rusher. It's a whole host of individuals that have done an awful lot for me and opened doors for me. But I've always been opposed to being dependent, and to the extent that I've always personally been opposed to the employer-employee relationship, which is a fundamental issue. And I think that's a major part of the problem. Of course, some of you know when I chaired the EEOC transition team for President Reagan in 1980, basically my report said, let's abolish the EEOC because it's a major source of the problem. The administration wasn't willing to go for that. I couldn't even get them to rescind the executive order, 11246. So, and I just reminded Ed Meese about that the day before yesterday when we had a board meeting on victims of crime. And But that's the way it goes. You don't get everything you want. You don't get people to do what you want to do, want them to do. And so I just move on and do the best I can and try not to allow these things to affect me adversely. And I have a whole agenda of things I would like to do, but it's just not going to happen in my lifetime. I try and convince individual people personally to not buy into this dependency or this victimology, if you will. And it's sort of what Shelby Steele was talking about last night, about this white guilt. Well, see, I view it from the other side. If I can convince enough minorities, enough black people individually, not to buy into this, not to want to be a part of this, we're in much better shape. And then they can just tell, starting with the Jesse Jackson, or anybody else, including President Bush, I just don't need it. I don't want it. Do what you want for yourself, take care of your own family, and leave me alone. And if we get to that point, we'd be much better off, quite frankly. That takes some doing. And it's because we have a system where more and more people just believe in going on along with business as usual. And it's more comfortable for a lot of people that way, unfortunately. But as I said, I use that benchmark at age 9, and I'll be 68 November 1, All Saints Day. And my mom claims that she didn't allow me to be born until November 1, All Saints Day, because the day before was Halloween, and I needed all the help I could get. So, and I'm trying to hold up my end of the bargain, and, you know, it's, you know, I like to give a couple examples of individuals I've tried to work with over the years, and a lot of them fell through the cracks. But some of them, you know, that I've tried to work with individually. And Winston Elliott's here, and he mentioned, reminded me of a young fellow in Raleigh, North Carolina, who's now in the PhD program at Chapel Hill. And he remembers meeting him when he was a youth member of CNP, the Council for National Policy, several years ago. And Darren Waters is in that program now and graduate. I met him when he was at Liberty University. I gave a convocation address down in Lynchburg. And you sort of encourage these youngsters to just continue. And in the meantime, you're trying to convince the spouse and that his wife, and of course, when two kids came along, you have to help them out a little bit more because life gets more complicated. There are other people, and, you know, Alan Keyes, I met at a YAF convention in Pittsburgh in 1969, and when Arnie Steinberg invited him to our YAF convention, and of course, the rest of that is history. My wife is still yelling at him, and she likes to get in the lives of these young fellas and tell them what to do, even after they get older and their kids are in college and all the rest of it. She still considers them to be young fellas. Clarence Thomas, same way. He made the mistake of calling me one morning, and we became pretty good friends. And, of course, I tell everybody, you get one bite of the apple with me. I will do as much as I can for you. I will encourage you. I will make a phone call for you, write a letter for you. But pardon me the expression, but if you screw up, you're dog meat. And I would tell them that from the very beginning. And generally, I would invite them to, say, breakfast at, say, the University Club in Washington, D.C., you know, of late. And then at 6:45 or so, and to see if they're serious about showing up that early in the morning. Because most people like to do lunch or dinner or something when they can get up late and that sort of business and waste my time. But I make them show up early. As a matter of fact, this young kid, Darren Waters, showed up for breakfast at the University Club, drove from Lynchburg early that morning. So that's always the first meeting. And it's simply a test to see if there's any seriousness on the part of these individuals. And I only mention those few names just to let you know, but I've had to babysit people you know, here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, back when I was state chairman of YAF, like Frank Donatelli, Jim Taylor, Bob Moffitt, and I can tell you stories about these kids. And back in those days, keep in mind, I was the only black guy, the kid involved with this all-white group. And I had probably, in my view, the best organization of Young Americans Freedom in the history of YAF. And you look at some of the people that we developed here in Pennsylvania, including the Society for Individual Liberty people, which became ultimately the Libertarian Party, and they're the ones I had the big fight with in 1969, the YAF convention in, the Pittsburgh convention was 67, I'm sorry, and the YAF convention in 69 was in St. Louis, at the Gateway Arch. But just the big fight I had with those folks, including Congressman Dana Rohrabacher and a few other people, and who fashioned themselves as being thoroughgoing libertarians. Well, it's fine. It was Butch Calloway here and Don Ernstberger and several other individuals. And people that I introduced to Ayn Rand. But I also introduced them to Russell Kirk and Frank Meyer and Bill Buckley and with their books and all the rest of this stuff. And any books I could get from Vic Milione at ISI then, whom I met in 1955, and all of the other folks. But I go back almost 50 years now. And it's been a long journey. And I've been fairly consistent in my view about all of this stuff. And it's important to realize that you've got to convince individuals as individuals. I don't believe in the Billy Graham approach where you fill up Yankee Stadium and you browbeat 60, 70, 80,000 people. I prefer to do it one-on-one. I think I've been more effective that way. I think I have a few examples to demonstrate that that I'm a pretty good salesman. And I like to say I can sell refrigerators to Eskimos. But I believe in what's in my heart of hearts. And maybe it goes back to my Sunday school days when my grandfather came over from Savannah, Georgia, and there's the connection with Clarence Thomas also. I lived in Savannah for a year and went to the same elementary school, 12 years apart, of course. But my grandfather founded one of the largest Baptist churches here in Philly, Zion Hill Baptist Church, 22nd and Carpenter Street. It's now at 53rd and Locust. And I was so serious about it to the extent I thought I would be the next pastor of the church until I realized that the black Baptist ministers were not serious. And we're talking about Marian Anderson's pastor, James Kirkland. We're talking about Marshall Shepherd of Vine Memorial, who was then recorded deeds here in Philadelphia. We're talking about a whole host of individuals outside of the city, of course. Adam Clayton Powell Jr., not the father, who was a close friend of Max Juergens back at the beginning. Now, I discovered these individuals were not serious about the Word of God. And so by the time I was 17, I walked away from my family's church, never to be seen again until I was invited back about 10 years ago for some event. And I was so disillusioned that I just said, well, something's wrong with this. And because they were more political than they were serious about, quote, saving souls, end quote. But then I discovered it's the same thing with the guy who was the first lay leader of the National Council of Churches of the USA, J. Irwin Miller. Used to head up Cummings Engines in Indianapolis. And that, just a wretched group of individuals, theologically, as far as I was concerned. And I just took a walk. I said, well, if I got to be on my own, I'm going to be on my own. That's it. I got involved with the Reformed Episcopal Church and eventually the Bible Presbyterian Church. And then we moved on from there. But then what I did as a result of that, watching what was going on with a lot of these individuals who were not serious, I said, well, I'm not the only one who's been fighting this battle. And now I see it in all kinds of denominations, not only within the Roman Catholic Church, but the Episcopal Church. And you got the split-offs of the Missouri Synod out there in St. Louis and the rest of it. So it wasn't just what I was experiencing as an individual. It was going on all over the place. And so I say that to you to let you know that as an individual, I'm willing to stand for what I believe in, and I've done it. I intend to continue doing it. And with that introduction, just so you know where I'm coming from, and if these individuals are not towing the mark, I'll give them a hard time also. But I'm delighted to have individuals with me, and I presume that... Bill, you want me to read their bios?
I don't think you need to do that.
Good, thank you. And we're going to start in order here. So it's sort of arbitrary, but we'll start in order. Mark Mavazzi, Randolph-Macon College, and he's going to talk to us about upheaval of heart. Mark, thank you.
Thank you.